loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, in a startling attack on one of the very foundations of the U.S. legal system, Robert Mueller's team based its indictment of Paul Manafort in part on the testimony of Manafort's own attorney. Next, ISIS has been driven out of its last pocket of the Syrian city of Deir ez-Zor by pro-government forces as the race for control of oil-rich eastern Syria continues. Then, Donald Trump is furious that Bo Bergdahl, the U.S. Army soldier held in captivity in Afghanistan for 5 years, was not given jail time as part of the sentence passed today. And finally, Spanish authorities have imprisoned 8 ministers of the now suspended government of Catalonia as the region gears up for a dramatic showdown in the December 21st Catalan election. That's all starting now on Loud and Clear. But first, in a startling attack on one of the very foundations of the U.S. legal system, Robert Mueller's team based their indictment of Paul Manafort in part on the testimony of Manafort's own attorney. We are joined from Washington by Mara Verheyden-Hilliard. She is the Executive Director of Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Welcome. Always good to have you, Mara.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be back.
Mara, this seems like a very disturbing trend. We've seen this now just in the last week in the Manafort case. We've seen it at Guantanamo. What is going on with attorneys being compelled to testify against their own clients? How is this legal?
Well, in the Manafort case, what's happened is Mueller and the Department of Justice sought to force an attorney for Manafort to testify before a grand jury. And the chief judge of the District of Columbia, a federal district court, ordered that she did, in fact, have to testify. And what Mueller was trying to do, and apparently did do, is force an attorney to testify about privileged communications with a client, focusing on the submissions that Manafort and Gates made under the FARA. But what this really means is that the government can come in and separate a defendant from his or her lawyer. And the ability to do that is so dangerous as to the capacity for anyone to be able to defend themselves when they're in the sights of the prosecution.
Well, let's just help the audience, which may not have been in court or may not have been, I don't know, may have been in court, but not well represented.
Paying attention.
Just explain why this principle, the principle of attorney-client confidentiality, is in many ways the cornerstone of a democratic system of jurisprudence.
Well, when the government comes after someone and seeks to prosecute them, and that person is entitled to have counsel, you need to be able to talk to your lawyer, and you need to be able to talk to your lawyer frankly and honestly. And your lawyer needs to be able to communicate to you and with you and be able to communicate on your behalf. And it's a core protection of the rights of a defendant in our society. But when the government comes in and tries to remove the attorney from the client by basically piercing attorney-client privilege, which is what was happening here, where the government is force the attorney to testify before a grand jury to reveal communications, it changes everything, and it puts the attorney also in a very particular position. In this case, notably, where what the government is saying is that the documents that were filed had false statements in them, and so the attorney must testify as to whether or not those false statements came from Manafort or whether the attorney herself made up false statements. So there's not a lot of options there. And then they use that to indict Manafort, saying that he used the attorney to carry out his illegal activities.
Mara, this just seems so patently unconstitutional on its face. Have there been legal precedents set to allow this? Has the Supreme Court ever made a ruling on something like this?
Well, it's interesting because, in fact, this is an issue that comes up within the American Bar Association and its ethics rules for lawyers. They have very specific guidelines as to the circumstances, the very limited circumstances in which a prosecutor might have any basis to try and get a hold of otherwise privileged attorney-client communications or work product protected material. And it's very, very strict. But what the federal government has done and federal prosecutors have done is said, well, that only applies in the context of state law, state bar ethics. And that as the federal government, they have, you know, the supremacy clause within the Constitution for grand juries, and they have the right to try and seek material that is a greater right and not unethical to do so. I mean, here, of course, they did have to go through a judge, and the judge did have to evaluate whether or not she felt that they were meeting what's called the crime fraud exception, which is the idea that there was the attorney involved in part of the crime. But you can imagine the vast number of cases where someone is being charged with a crime, and of course they're consulting with an attorney. So at what point is the attorney involved in perpetrating a crime fraud for defending their client?
You know, it seems to me that ought to be up to an investigator to determine. And if the investigator can't determine it, then tough luck for the prosecutor. He's not able to file criminal charges.
And the idea should be, and is supposed to be, that the high bar to sort of pierce this would be that they can't get this information from any other means. The information is absolutely necessary. But you can see here, with the use of it in this case, the huge number of situations where this would come up. But of course, there isn't a huge outcry about this right now because, you know, we have a situation where you have people that normally would be steadfast defenders of civil liberties and civil rights looking at Manafort and the prosecutions. And, you know, it's tough for people to feel really bad about a guy that's, you know, taking millions of dollars and going on a spending spree. And, you know, they all think like, yeah, go get him. But, you know, when you have that kind of attitude that to civil rights and civil liberties, regardless of who is the defendant, it's incredibly dangerous because they're going to use it there. They can use it in a large number of other circumstances. I mean, many of the organizations that themselves progressively defended the rights of Gitmo detainees are just silent on what's happening in the Mueller prosecution.
When someone's arrested, the police are required to read you your Miranda rights. And it says, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you can say, anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to an attorney. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be provided for you. So there's obviously a danger that the system has now recognized that people must have the right to a lawyer and not to have to speak to the police. But if now you're speaking to your lawyer and then your lawyer is compelled by subpoena to testify in a grand jury about what you and your lawyer talked about, it seems to me that the whole right to remain silent, that just kind of goes away. And if you have a right to an attorney, so what?
And, you know, the FBI does not have to read you your rights. I spent 2 years in prison after being sentenced to 30 months, and no one ever read me my rights. So the times have changed since 1965.
Mara, the judge in this case began her ruling by declaring the reason that she allowed the Manafort's lawyer, former lawyer, to be compelled after Manafort said, no, we don't want him to testify. The reason he could be compelled by subpoena to testify before the grand jury was, quote, this is a matter of national importance. That's the judge's basis for allowing this seemingly elastic definition of what it means to have a confidentiality. It's of national importance. I mean, that seems to me very subjective. I mean, it's not like Paul Manafort is accused of having like an armed group that was trying to carry out a terrorist attack. What the charges are was that Manafort had connections with Ukrainian politicians, that he was able as a lobbyist to derive a large amount of money on the basis of representing these forces in Washington, D.C., that he kept that money offshore. He didn't report it to the IRS. In other words, it's tax evasion. And then he used that money to buy properties in the United States, a kind of money laundering, and used those properties then to get additional loans from U.S. banks. And they got them, he got them presumably at a lower rate because he had collateral with these the properties he had purchased from this unreported income. And thus that was defrauding the bank because the banks, because they were giving him a lower number for what he had to pay back for interest. Why is that of national importance, Mara? Why is that of, that sounds like criminal activity, but why is that of, quote, national importance? And what does that even mean?
Well, certainly if the Justice Department was suddenly going to set its sights on putting this amount of resources into prosecuting financial fraud, offshore accounts, money laundering. I mean, I think there's just whole, you know, blocks of K Street in Washington, D.C. that would be in jail, But what the judge also did in this ruling is she really made what is a preliminary finding of guilt, saying that it does appear this crime was committed, so therefore the government is allowed to pierce the attorney-client privilege and force an attorney to testify. And the focus in that element was the issue of the Foreign Agent Registration Act, and that the Justice Department had demanded that certain filings be made. Those filings were made, and the government says those, the representations in the filings were false. So it's turning back to the lawyer to say, well, did your client give you false information? And you can see in the indictment that then Mueller refers back to those filings and says that Manafort used the attorney to as a conduit for providing false information to the Justice Department.
Yeah, I think this might even be more insidious than the Washington Post article leads on, because something very similar has been happening, Brian, at Guantanamo, where Guantanamo defense attorneys have decided to resign rather than to just stand idly by while prosecutors confiscate standalone computers given to their clients to communicate with their attorneys and refuse to give these computers back. In addition, the room where Guantanamo defense attorneys normally meet with their clients has been deemed off limits for so-called national security reasons. And then we have a brigadier general who a couple of days ago was sentenced to 21 days in home confinement, I guess is what it finally came down to, because he supported the idea of allowing the defense attorneys to resign in protest.
Yeah, and he called this whole system a farce, this hybrid civilian-military commission. But yeah, you have a colonel sentencing a brigadier general to 21 days in confinement because he said lawyers have a right to retain their ethical position, not to represent clients who they really can't represent because the government is seizing their confidential discussions. Mara, we have about 2 minutes left. As you mentioned, in the last couple decades, at least, you would think liberals or people who think of themselves as liberals would be really sort of clinging to these basic rights that are being chipped away at, and maybe in this case, sort of seismically chipped away at. And yet, because it's directed against the Republicans or against Manafort or against Trump, it seems to be a very sort of nonchalant attitude about the loss of rights. I mean, talk about what that means, big picture.
Right now, where you have, this prosecution bringing in of Mueller, who's being cheered on by many who present themselves as liberal or even progressive people, and it's unleashing just the weight of the government in a manner that is so violative of people's rights. And, since when, for people that are progressive people, people on the left, do they look at the FBI as the entity that's going to, save American democracy? But, this is a classic situation where, you can have a witch burning and then burn the whole village down. And with this ruling and the silence from progressive and civil liberties organizations over it, and, going as far as to just the complete extreme hysteria over these prosecutions, when you read the indictments carefully, they really don't say what liberal media or the mainstream media is claiming, they say, it's very defining about the nature of the society that we're in right now and what people are hearing, what they are perceiving, regardless of what the actual facts are.
Thank you, Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, the Executive Director of Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, for joining us. This is Loud and Clear. Please stay tuned.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
ISIS has been driven out of its last pocket of the Syrian city of Deir ez-Zor by pro-government military forces as the race for control of oil-rich eastern Syria continues. We are joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He is an international security and affairs analyst. Welcome back, Mark.
Hi, Brian. John, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Thank you for joining. Thank you. This is a big deal, right?
Yes, this is a big deal. It's been a couple months in coming. It was 2 months ago that Syrian forces and their allies began the fight to fully liberate the city of Deir ez-Zor. And this is a special city because it has withstood siege for 5 years. That's two years under Al-Qaeda, who was the predecessor to ISIS in the region, and then 3 years to ISIS itself. And we're talking some 2,000 Syrian military, some 5,000 police and draftees, withheld this city under siege in the midst of ISIS territory, protecting over 100,000 citizens and the Syrian government's strategic foothold in the east for 5 years. And then that's kind of a miracle in itself. But then the fact that the Syrian government was able to reclaim vast swaths of desert in a three-pronged assault, liberate the airport, bring relief to the city, get supplies in, and then clear out today, the final word is that the last bit of the city itself has been cleared of the last holdout dug in ISIS forces. Both morale wise for the Syrian government's ability to strategically hold the east, this is very important, because if Deir ez-Zor had fell to ISIS and then been liberated by the Syrian Democratic Forces, these Kurdish and Arab tribes that are proxies of the U.S., the U.S. would have been able to use Deir ez-Zor as its basis for partitioning all of East Syria. So that's why it's important that it not fall.
So, Mark, has the Syrian government gotten to the point of mop-up operations? Is it that far advanced?
With ISIS in the east, it was very close to that point. Both Syrian government forces and Iraqi forces on the other side of the border are now converging on the twin cities of Abu Kamal on the Syrian side and Al-Qaim on the Iraqi side of the border. These are twin cities on the south side of the Euphrates. Iraqi forces and coordinating have already seized the border crossing. They're really small. There are towns, but it's the last major urban area in the east. We're already starting to see ISIS try to melt off into the desert, into refugee camps and the like. But there are other holdout ISIS forces scattered across the country in small areas, usually adjacent to West and GC-backed rebel areas. But this just heralds the future fight of Syria, because now the race for territory and the tense situation between U.S.-backed SDF proxies and the Syrian government in the east, the race to secure oil and gas fields in that area is ongoing. It's a very tense situation. Plus, you still have all of Idlib province under the control of al-Qaeda, and a huge portion of north-central Syria adjacent to that, held by Turkish forces and their proxy, New Syrian Army, which, according to reports, is cooperating fully with al-Qaeda, and Turkish troops are now stationed in al-Qaeda-held Idlib, around the Kurdish canton of Afrin. So there's still multiple steps that the Syrian government has to, and other opponents that the Syrian government has to overcome to reclaim their whole country. It's still probably years in the making. But this is ISIS's death now. It's been a long time in coming, but these are the last rat holes they're being routed out of, the last major urban centers.
So if one were to look at the map of Syria, just for our audience, which of course we're not TV, we're radio, so people will just have to do that later or just let me describe it. You have Damascus, the capital of Syria, that's in the southwest part of the country. In the northwest part of the country is Idlib, Aleppo, which has now been liberated, but Idlib is still under the control of al-Qaeda and these kind of military forces. In the vast eastern part of Syria, less populated, you have Raqqa, sort of eastern central along the Tigris and Euphrates River, or the Euphrates. And then southeast of that is Deir ez-Zor. So what we're seeing basically is the Syrian Arab army controlling now the southern and eastern part of Syria. But in the northern eastern part, it's really Americans working with the Kurds, who actually are the military force. What happens next over there? I mean, do you envision, Mark Sloboda, that these two forces, these two military forces, could end up clashing?
Yes, that is extremely likely. Now, the important point of that then is, does the U.S. and Russia then join into that? Does someone back down in the region? The Trump administration continues to insist, despite all the facts of what they're doing on the ground, that they believe in Syria's territorial integrity, and they're not interested in a partition of the country, only defeating ISIS. Well, ISIS is being defeated at this moment, and then, you know, the coming next couple of months, the U.S. will quickly run out of excuses why it has troops in Syria. And we just saw a press conference with the Pentagon the other day where the U.S. general was asked how many U.S. forces are in Syria, and he said 4,000, and then the press questioned him, "I thought there were only 500. And then he said, like, "Yes, you're right, there's only 500. So this was kind of a big Freudian slip point. But it seems likely that there are at least 4,000 U.S. forces in the region, and that's usually not counting special forces and others. The problem for the U.S. is that the Kurds, while secular and the preferred partner of the Pentagon all along, vice the CIA, who supported Islamist rebels and the rest of the country that were allied with al-Qaeda, the Kurds were at least secular, reasonable negotiations, possible compromise possible with them. But they're a very poor partition partner. One, because the Kurds have long, the SDF has long ago moved into territory that is not Kurdish majority. And the Sunni Arabs in that part of the country are generally not very enthusiastic about being under Kurdish rule. I mean, these Kurdish groups still have very real roots today in anarcho-Marxism, which isn't exactly an ideology that fits well in that area. Plus, the U.S.'s two geopolitical strongholds in the region, Turkey, which is a member of NATO, and Iraq, the Iraqi government, which the U.S. Installed in Iraq, are both have their own problems, their own possible separatism issues with the Kurds, and so they're not likely to want to see part of Syria adjacent to both of their borders become some type of de facto Kurdish state. So the U.S. is running out of both tactical options on the ground as well as geopolitical options in the region. They've just
pose a very poor partner if partition is their plan. At this point, they seem to have not made it up their mind. They've kind of muddled through up to this point, but it's coming down where they will have to make a decision. Are they going to withdraw from Syria and allow some type of reconciliation to take place between the Kurds and the central government in Damascus, or are they going to push the Kurds for partition?
Mark, President Donald Trump, at the beginning of this week, took personal credit for the defeat of ISIS in Syria. And then in response to the terrorist attack in New York, said that he would respond by killing 1,000 ISIS fighters. Is that even possible?
I imagine there are still several thousand ISIS fighters running around. And we have to remember that ISIS is now an international threat. I mean, they are in not only Iraq and Syria, but in Libya, in the Philippines,
India, Afghanistan. They're all over the place.
Yemen, yeah, other countries as well. So, I mean, if he's looking for some kind of biblical justice, taking 10 eyes for one eye or something of the sort, then he can probably certain find enough ISIS fighters.
Well, I wondered though if he was just looking for something for these U.S. troops in Syria to do. It, as an excuse to stay.
Well, the U.S. continues to insist that the counterterrorism fight against ISIS will continue long after ISIS ceases to hold any territory. And they can probably keep up that bluff for a long time. They will claim to be fighting an insurgency. And they continue to insist, despite all credible evidence, that it is the Syrian government's presence itself which inspires terrorism and ISIS rather than the U.S.'s continued intervention in the region, first knocking down the Iraqi government and then supporting jihadis who various groups and at times have actually been allied with ISIS. Thus feeding them with money, weapons, and so on, and the power vacuum that was created in eastern Syria eastern Syria and western Iraq that allowed ISIS to come about. I see this far more as a consequence of repeated U.S. Ill-considered intervention in the region rather than anything to do specifically with the Syrian government.
Mark Sloboda, last week, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said that the rule of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad was coming to an end. Is it?
It's not even realistic. It's a question of which planet Tillerson is on. I mean, there around the internet, there are various checkboards going around of all the Western and Gulf Cooperation Council, their Arab allies, who have said Assad must go and have themselves seen themselves removed from power or died or voted out long before that. The question as far as the Russian government is concerned is that it has never been about the person of Bashar al-Assad, but that he is the Syrian president and it is the continuation of the Syrian government and central authority that is most important. And after the territorial integrity of the country is completely restored and order is restored, elections will take place, and then it's a matter for the Syrian people to decide whether Assad goes or stays. Certainly not the U.S. Secretary of State, be that from the Obama administration or now with the Trump administration.
Okay, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He is an international security and affairs analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and Clear. And Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. We're going to be talking in this segment about the sentencing of Bo Bergdahl. He was convicted of deserting, court-martialed by the U.S. Army, but he was given no jail time. He had been held captive by the Taliban for five years, tortured. Obviously a case that has a lot of politics, maybe mostly politics behind it. We're joined by Michael Preisner. He is the producer of Empire Files on Telesur. Mike is also an Iraq war veteran. He was a corporal in the U.S. Army and participated in the 2003 shock and awe invasion of Iraq before becoming a leading voice of anti-war veterans and a founder of the organization March Forward. Mike Prisner, welcome.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Were you surprised about the sentence?
You know, I wasn't surprised. I think the military court, you know, knew that he went through a really torturous, horrible experience, you know, 5 years in captivity and then 3 years after that, you know, being in the Army, essentially, and being in a pretty bad position in the Army. And I think that the court also was well aware of the circumstances under which he abandoned his post. This wasn't him running away because he was scared or the types of things that you think desertion is for, but left because he, you know, was trying to draw attention to the very real and serious problems that, he and his fellow soldiers were facing.
It became a big political football, John. I mean, you would think, okay, this guy was held by the Taliban for 5 years. Obama got him free in a prisoner exchange, that there would be, you know, he'd be welcomed with open arms. Just the opposite happened.
Yeah, and remember that military prosecutors initially recommended that Bergdahl not be prosecuted. It was later that that decision was reversed, and he was forced to face these criminal charges. He elected to plead guilty, even absent a deal. So he took a real chance. He was looking at the potential of a life sentence here. And then you have the president of the United States at the same time saying that he should be executed as a traitor. Apparently, Donald Trump doesn't know the definition of treason, which is outlined in the Constitution, and certainly it didn't apply to this case. And then just a few minutes ago, or not a few minutes, I guess it's a few hours ago, Trump tweeted, "The decision on Sergeant Bergdahl is a complete and total disgrace to our country and to our military. Utterly unfair," I would say.
It's also quite amazing. I was somebody who organized against the Vietnam War, so I had a lot of sympathy for working class people who were trying to not fight, or those who went in and tried to organize against the war from inside. Donald J. Trump, like all the other rich kids, was able to avoid any military service because he had, what was it, bone spurs or...
Bone spurs.
You know, that's
Bone spurs was for one of his six deferments. He claimed bone spurs, but he had many other deferments for different.
I'm surprised, Mike, that he can even golf with, you know, with those bone spurs. I mean, how does he walk around? Yeah, the decision on Sergeant Bergdahl is a complete and total disgrace to our country and to our military. During the election campaign, Mike Prisner, Donald Trump said he's a dirty, rotten traitor, Bo Bergdahl. Why the venom against this man?
You know, it's interesting because I remember growing up, I mean, part of the reason that, you know, young men and women join the military is you kind of grow up seeing these POW MIA flags and monuments everywhere you go, right? I mean, U.S. prisoners of war are supposed to be kind of like the most revered veterans or revered people in general in our society. And then here's Bo Bergdahl, captured by the Taliban for 5 years, horribly tortured. I mean, in interviews he's done, he said that he was kept in the dark for so long that he couldn't remember what he looked like and couldn't confirm who he was or what he looked like. I mean, really kind of psychologically torturous things. But I think that he became a symbol of opposition to the Afghanistan war, even though that he wasn't really saying that, or maybe his politics aren't like that right now. But what couldn't be ignored is that the reason that he walked off his base, and actually he said the reason that he's walked off his base and done an interview, a pretty extensive interview about what was going through his mind when he walked off this base. And you have to remember the context in which he did this. This is in 2009. And what defined the Afghanistan war in 2009, I actually have many friends who were there at this time and have told me about this firsthand, is that you had these tiny outposts scattered all across the middle of nowhere in Afghanistan that served no strategic purpose. And because of their remoteness, could not get supplied, could not get air support, were just completely left out, like, you know, just to be shot at and blown up every single day, all day and all night, with really no support, just so a bunch of generals could point at a map and say, look, we're controlling all of Afghanistan. See, we have these outposts all over the country. When really these were just really terrible experiences. And so many soldiers had discontent over this situation. So many were getting killed, losing their lives for something that they could see no purpose in and could see the supreme mismanagement at the top. And so Bo Burdell saw himself as, like, and he even said, like, a Jason Bourne or even Edward Snowden type of person, where he thought that if he walked off the base and walked to a different base far away, it would trigger a huge investigation into the problems on the bases. Because he said he wanted to raise these things in his chain of command on the base, but of course no one would do anything, and they were all left dangling. And so in his mind, this is going to try to save some American lives and stop, like, occupying these kind of disparate, you know, pointless areas of Afghanistan.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, another thing too, that that the likes of Donald Trump and military prosecutors ignored is a history of well-documented mental illness. This is a guy who may not have been in his right mind the whole time he was coming to the conclusions about what he wanted to do. And what Donald Trump wanted to do was to treat him as someone who thought this through and voluntarily decided to commit treason, which obviously he did not do.
Right, exactly. And it's also, you know, who can explain the reason to be in Afghanistan now? I mean, and
right.
having to say why he did this would have to, you know, cause the politicians and the military to explain, you know, why did he need to be at that outpost, or why does anyone need to be in Afghanistan now? I mean, I think people kind of gone on so long that people forget what it is. I mean, we've never been engaged in a war this long. There's 12 casualty U.S. Deaths in 2017. So it's a war that's still, while they're low, still drawing U.S. casualties, still a very high number of casualties of people in Afghanistan. But people kind of forget that it exists. And, you know, none of the generals, none of the politicians can give one good reason why it needs to continue. And so issues like this, you know, they wanted to turn Bo Burdell into some kind of someone who questioned the war, and therefore he must be, tortured and executed, because they can't actually explain why we have to be there themselves.
You know, one of the things that came to my mind, Mike Prysner, when you were talking about the fact that these soldiers, these infantry people, were out at remote posts so that the generals could point at a map and say, see, we control this territory, when in fact they controlled nothing. These outposts were completely surrounded. It reminded me of what the soldiers and rank-and-file Marines were thinking and feeling during Vietnam, because, you know, the great power that America had against the Vietnamese during the Vietnam War was air power, but they couldn't find the guerrillas. The only way they could find the guerrillas was to send the infantry out to engage them in the jungle. And so the infantry was kind of bait. In other words, your platoon would go out, it would draw fire, you'd call in the coordinates, then the massive air power could come in and try to hit the National Liberation Front guerrillas. And then you'd retreat from the area. You'd take a hill to draw fire and then have the Air Force come in and bomb, and then you'd give up the hill. And so there was this profound alienation from rank-and-file soldiers who said, we don't know why we're in Vietnam. We don't know what we're accomplishing. We don't know why we take a hill and then give it up the next day. We're completely expendable. Meanwhile, the generals, the brass, they don't have to be held to account at all because, well, it's a chain of command. Completely understandable in these long, drawn-out military conflicts. I mean, in fact, this becomes, I mean, this explained in large part why American soldiers and American troops became such a big factor in the American anti-war movement in 1969, 70, 71, another part of American history that's not very well told.
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny, these missions are actually called draw fire missions. I mean, I've been on a few of those myself. It's you go somewhere where you know there's a high likelihood you'll get shot at, precisely to just get shot at, so that your commander can get a medal and, you know, you can call in air support on that area. But yeah, I mean, that's precisely what the Afghanistan war was for many of the years of the war. I mean, now they've kind of, with, you know, retreated and drawn back into, like, these bigger bases. But it was essentially the same thing. I mean, and countless soldiers have come out and tried to raise this with their congressmen, with their military commanders, try to get some kind of end to that situation. But it's been described as a Tom and Jerry cartoon, you know, running down the hallway that never ends. I mean, every day you wake up, you go on a pointless patrol through a pointless area, someone's going to get blown up, someone's going to get a leg blown off, or someone's going to get shot. Then you leave, get back from the patrol, back on your base, and you spend all night getting bombarded with rockets and mortars all night. I mean, and that was just the over and over again every single day in Afghanistan, while at the same time, you know, no one could explain what the purpose of all that was. Because if they, you know, were honest about what the purpose was, of course, everyone would walk off their base and stop the war at the same time. And so we have to recognize that this is still the situation there, although in a different way. But yeah, I mean, that was really the impetus for so much resistance in the Vietnam War, and also so much of the resistance in the Iraq War and a little bit in the Afghanistan War, too. I mean, a mission that cannot be defined, where it's very obviously a crime against humanity, against the people that you're occupying. And, you know, complete incompetence in the leadership that's just getting so many people pointlessly killed and made amputees. And that was the situation that Bo Burdell was in.
Mike, you're an Iraq War vet. Tell us what a soldier can do to blow the whistle on something like this. I mean, we saw what Chelsea Manning did, and we saw what happened to Chelsea Manning for doing it. But what's the average soldier able to do? Do you have to go through your chain of command? Can you go to the Congressional Oversight Committees or to the Pentagon Inspector General?
Sure. Well, there's different. I mean, there's different situations. One, if you're deployed, you're in a very different situation than if you're in garrison, you know, here in the United States or at your base. Bo Burdell was in one of those situations where he wanted to report problems, but you know, he is on a remote outpost in the middle of nowhere. The highest ranking person he could report to is his captain, and then you know that wasn't going to go anywhere. You know, walking off the base was the option that he thought, but that was the only way he thought he could communicate. I mean, he was writing to his dad, telling him these things too, and whatever. But I mean, the military isn't really interested in hearing from enlisted soldiers' complaints and ways that they think things should be changed. And so there's really no real recourse that soldiers can take in their chain of command or with their congressmen. I mean, they've been trying it for the entire duration of the Afghanistan war, and none of it has worked. But what they can do is take charge of their own lives and their friends' lives, and refuse to take part in it. I mean, I know people, members who were in March Forward, who were deployed to Iraq, and who took the firing pins out of their rifles and turned them into their commanders and said, I'm not going to get killed for no reason and not going to get killed occupying people we have no reason to occupy. People in garrison, of course, have much more leeway because they're not in harm's way directly. But every single person in the U.S. military right now has the right to refuse to deploy to Afghanistan or Syria or Africa or any of the other places that the U.S. military is trying to send them. I've been a part of helping so many conscientious objectors, you know, just simply refuse, and they've all gotten honorable discharges when they stand up and assert their rights. And it is a right for all soldiers.
Very important voice. Michael Preisner, Iraq War veteran. He's the producer of Empire Files on Telesur. After a short break, we'll be right back. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Spanish authorities have imprisoned 8 ministers of the now suspended government of Catalonia as the region gears up for a dramatic showdown in the December 21st Catalan elections. We are joined from Barcelona by Dick Nichols. He is the correspondent for Spain and Catalonia for Green Left Weekly. Welcome back, Dick Nichols.
Good, Brian. Nice to be back.
Thank you for joining again for our audience. Dick Nichols has been a frequent guest here as this crisis unfolds so dynamically. 8 sacked Catalan ministers have been remanded in custody by a Spanish high court judge. How does that play out right now where you are?
Well, what it does in Catalonia is produce enormous outrage. Yesterday we had demonstrations, spontaneous demonstrations in every major and most of the whole country. We had 20,000 people in front of the parliament, just like that. 10,000 in provincial capitals, and at 10 o'clock in the night there was a what they call a casolada, which is a banging of pots and pans. Which was deafening, which was just across the whole of the country. And now we've got a series of demonstrations that will, tonight we'll have another casolada, then there'll be a next Saturday, they're aiming for the biggest demonstration, they can possibly do against this incredible outrage. Because it should be explained to your listeners that this is just they're on remand. They've been charged, but there was no need to put these people in jail. They could have been just charged and then, be in contact with the police or be able to be contacted with. But no, it was a deliberate policy of humiliation and sticking them in jail. And it's the same policy they applied to the two leaders of the Catalan mass independence movement. So that's where we're at. And as I say, it's produced an enormous outrage here and pressure for a more united ticket at the December 21 election so that the pro-sovereignty vote can be as high as possible.
Dick, these are very heavy charges, and they include things like sedition and rebellion. Very, very hard crimes. But there's a process now. If the Spanish High Court issues a warrant, a European arrest warrant is supposed to be sent to Belgian prosecutors. They have a certain amount of time to decide if they're going to respect it and enforce it. They don't necessarily have to. And indeed, sedition and rebellion, two of these accusations, are not on the list of offenses that would compel the Belgians to turn Puigdemont and these other ministers over to the Spanish government. What do you think the chances are that we're going to see a standoff now between the Spanish government and the Belgian government?
Well, I think it's highly likely. I think it's highly likely. I think they've issued, I haven't got the latest news, but I think they're certainly going to issue a European arrest warrant for Puigdemont and the four other ministers who are in Belgium. As you say, these charges are not on the list. These charges are actually, by the way, not from the old Francoist legislation, i.e. the old dictatorship legislation, and they just stayed on the books after the transition to democracy. So this is, you get some idea of how grotesque all this is. The charge of rebellion was designed in case of an actual military mutiny, uprising, violent shooting, prelude to a civil war. And this is being applied to people who have always pursued peaceful means. In the case of Belgium, they've got a problem because the Belgian the Belgian legal system ruled in the past that they wouldn't extradite people who were connected with ETA, that was the Basque military organisation, and they actually ended up with this sort of political asylum in Flanders, in the Flemish part of Belgium. It's not automatic that there would be extradition. And what happens is it goes to the Belgian courts. If the courts decide so, it can then go to the parliament. So it can rapidly become a political hot potato. And I noticed yesterday the Belgian Prime Minister said he instructed his ministers to make no comments on the Catalan case, because it would destabilize, one of these, fragile government coalition.
Right.
So, I think it's highly likely that it's highly likely that they will not extradite Puigdemont. But, you don't know. But of course, they will come under massive pressure from France and Germany and all the other powers who are on the side of Madrid.
Brian, it seems that Puigdemont and the other ministers can make a case that they're being discriminated against because of their politics. And the European arrest warrant law specifically says that an arrest warrant is not valid if it is based on a person's individual politics.
Yeah, and let's just go back to what
they can do that. Sorry, could I just interrupt? They can do that, and then it becomes an actual judgment or a discussion about constitutionality, either the Spanish saying, "Oh, this is all constitutional; it's all done by the book," and democratic rights, which is precisely the discussion that Puigdemont is wanting to push.
That's right.
And just let's remember what this all stems from, because we have to keep going back. The crime here was the Catalan regional government that Puigdemont was the head of went ahead with a referendum. It went ahead with a vote, and the vote was for independence, and then Puigdemont declared independence and then essentially rescinded it or put it on hold and called for the Spanish government to negotiate. In other words, even if the Spanish government was 100% opposed, as they are, to Catalan independence, the actual methods that they've used to suppress this process has had the exact opposite impact of their intended objective. Because, of course, under these circumstances, the Catalan independence movement looks like the victim of aggression. It doesn't look like the aggressor. It doesn't look like, because they haven't, say, taken up arms to force a separation. They had a vote, and as a consequence of the vote, their leaders have gone into exile. Now arrest warrants. The people who remain in Catalonia are being not only arrested, as Dick Nichols said, but actually remanded to custody. I mean, this whole idea of the Spanish government is that you can beat down what's essentially a peaceful movement. You know, this is what the U.S. tried to do in the case of the civil rights movement here in the South. It always has the opposite impact. There's a lot of suffering that can be imposed on people, but it always has the opposite impact, and yet central government authorities keep reverting to it.
Well, they can't, and if I just interrupt there, they can't do any other way because that's in their nature. Their only way, the Spanish central authorities, who are defending the most holy thing in the universe, which is the unity of the Spanish state, the only way you can defend the unity of the Spanish state is by denying the right to self-determination in a country that is multi, if plurinational. And hence, when you have a big national movement, you have only one tool, which is repression. And when the movement comes back against you, and in this case, with peaceful mass Gandhian sort of tactics, then you just repress more. And what you say is dead right. The message that is going out to ordinary people in Europe is that the Catalans are just peaceful people trying to get a decision about their relationship to the Spanish state, and they're being bashed for it. And that's precisely the intention. And Puigdemont is a master at this tactic. He's a master at getting the message across.
Puigdemont said that he would be willing to return to Spain and to face trial if he is guaranteed a fair trial. Is a fair trial possible? Would such a trial take place in Catalonia? How is it possible to have a fair trial?
Well, I can't answer that because you would then have to have a discussion about actual criteria for what a fair trial would be in the Spanish state. And what Puigdemont is doing and what is actually putting the Spanish legal system on trial itself. So then you would have to have a discussion about, you know, well, what would the actual criteria be? And that would become a question of negotiation between his lawyers and the Spanish state. But they're never going to accept that.
No.
They're not going to accept that because that means treating, and this has been their red line they will not cross ever since this began. They will not treat Puigdemont, they will not treat the Catalan cause in general as an equal and opposite thing with which they have to negotiate.
That would legitimize it.
That would legitimize it. It's just a province which we are going to crush. Now we're going to put under control. I must say, I should just say one thing, which is every time they do this, support for independence goes up. So the latest poll we have here, which is a reliable poll, it has a big sample, is that pro-independence sentiment jumped 7% from 41 to 40, from 42 to 49% since this phase of events has started.
And it was the central government that called for December election.
They called for the election because they thought this was a smart way to try and exploit the divisions. Potential divisions between boycottists and participationists on the Catalan independence side, but that's been resolved because everybody's going to participate now, so that's a problem for them. And the other thing they wanted to do, they desperately need to do, is show Europe that they've got not just might on their side, but right, legitimacy. And people keep underestimating this here. But it's not, you can't just govern on the basis of having the coppers and the courts on your side. You've got to have legitimacy. And the legitimacy would be that their people, the unionists, would win in December 21. But that doesn't look very likely at the moment.
Wow, that'll be huge, right? Yeah. Because another unpredicted stage of the struggle, the Spanish central government, in fact, tries to replace the Catalan government, have new elections. If they lose those elections... Wow.
Well, if they lose their people are already asking them, well, will you reimpose Article 155, which is the article of the Constitution under which they're doing this intervention and removing the Catalan government, will you reintroduce that? And they're not giving a clear answer to that.
Dick, in our last minute, just explain to Americans who won't really be familiar with how the Spanish government and the Spanish Constitution organizes Spain. I mean, in like here in the United States, we have 50 states. They have some powers. They have some limited powers. Talk about the regions in Spain and how it actually works, what the Constitution actually says.
Well, the Constitution is ambiguous because the Constitution was a result of a deal between the old Francoist dictatorship forces and the anti-dictatorship forces, and you ended up with contradictory articles in the Constitution. Article 1 says Spain is united, indivisible, right? And Spain is the nationality that everybody has. Spanish is the nationality. But then you have other articles which allow the regions, the states, what they call autonomous communities here, to actually vote on issues of importance to them. So hence here, there's a huge fight between lawyers as to whether or not you could have a legal referendum, because then you have they're having a discussion between lawyers about and jurists about whether it is possible to have a legal referendum under the Spanish Constitution. Of course it's possible, because there's already been referendum only for Catalans on whether or not they accepted a statute of autonomy in 2006. But it's the interpretation, the centralist interpretation of the Constitution by the Spanish government that has produced the situation we're in at the moment.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined from Barcelona by Dick Nichols. He is the correspondent for Spain and Catalonia for Green Left Weekly. We'll be back Monday. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM. And also at SputnikNews.com. You can also subscribe to our broadcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.